Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is another episode of Strange Dominions. I am your host, Octavian Graves. We have a very special episode for you tonight. I'm speaking with Nidjafol, author and musician, author of Mark Thrutheblot, Nightside of Norse Mythology. We speak on a range of topics from paganism, heathenism, esoteric and occult practices, as well as music and his own paranormal experiences. If you have had a paranormal experience or experience with something you can't explain, please send us an email at strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com. That is strangedominionspodcast@gmail.com, and you can be a host on the show. Our Patreon is up, and by the time this episode airs, there should be merchandise for each of the tiers, as well as more explanation on how the Patreon works. And with that, let's get into the show. All right, tonight we are with Nidjafol, the author and musician, author of Mørkets Blot, Nightside of Old Norse Mythology. How you doing?
Oh, not too bad. And yourself?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. Glad to hear.
Thank you. So I just have to say that this book is fantastic. I mean, it's fun to read. It's informative. It's not too long. It's not too short. It's got the right amount of pages. It's got all the information. It's just very understandable and just really fun to read. So
thank you. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, it's my pleasure.
It's definitely something that I was conscious about when I was writing it, because I mean, I can sit here and put out a bunch of words and names that people are not going to understand and just kind of, hey, figure it out yourself. But I thought it would be easier if I gave backstory in a simple amount of space to where I can say what I want to say and provide enough context where people know what I'm talking about, even if you really don't have a single clue about Norse mythology in general. And it's something I've been hearing a lot. So thank you for saying that, because I'm glad. Because to me, it's like, as long as people keep saying, hey, I don't really know a lot about Norse mythology, but your book was very easy to read and it made me understand, like, that's the most I could really ask for. So I'm very appreciative of that.
Yeah, man, it's well deserved. The cool thing about it is, like you said, even if someone doesn't know anything about Norse mythology or like the Eddas or the sources, you have all of the examples for your points in the book laid out, easy to understand. It's a lot. I've read a lot of books, especially within the Norse tradition, where instead of it, you know, when it comes to the actual practice of it, a lot of authors seem to expect that their readers have some kind of cursory knowledge of the actual sources, not just the general mythology.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's very fair to say, because I believe that if you're going to be digging into books of that contain to information like this, as far as, you know, left hand path magic or any kind of esoteric wisdom or knowledge out there, you really should have at least a basic idea, whether it's, you know, Satanism, Norse, it doesn't matter. But again, I really wanted to hammer that point home and say, like, look, even if you don't know a lot, at least I can give you the basics while I do it.
Well, I think the great thing is that with the examples you put in, it makes, at least for me, I went back and read my Eddas, my copies, just to get some more context just for myself. But I don't know, I feel like it would inspire someone to be like, oh, okay, well, this is good information, but maybe I should go back and try and find out like what the full context is.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's definitely no shortage of context when it comes to the Eddas.
One thing that I've always questioned is, and I'm curious to see how you grappled with this when you got into it and how you went around it with your research. We know that at least the prose Edda was either written by a Christian or, you know, at least was written in heavily Christianized time of Iceland. So the information is obviously to some extent, probably a lot, But just from a if we're being conservative about it, it's got some Christianization in it, and it's got some alterings of the atmosphere and the aesthetic of the tales. And so I'm wondering, as an author and as a researcher, how you were able to, like, did you just kind of deal with it and went off of what was in the Eddas as the source, or did you pick through it, or, you know, how was your how did you grapple with that?
To be completely honest with you, I think that argument is probably pushing above its weight class. While there may be, you know, like, to me, I don't really think it matters. And the reason why is because at the time that the Prose Eddas was written, which is in the 1100s, yes, Iceland may have been Christianized at that time, but regardless of whether or not Snorri was a Christian or he wasn't, he still took the time, patience, and effort to explain the beliefs of his ancestry. And I think that's the most important thing to put the focus on, is not whether or not the man who wrote it was a pagan or not. It's what is he saying? And more or less, he's just handing down these oral stories from, you know, a lot of Nordic tribes that he either were encountered or read about, or regardless. But to answer your question, it didn't really matter to me, only in the sense that what I would source the Eddas for were very specific things. So the examples that I have in my book, as you can see, like, they're pointing out very specific points or details. So the chances of me running into anything that was quote unquote Christianized are probably very slim. But even if it did happen, I would just refer to my previous answer of, I don't think it really matters.
I understand that. I think the argument from what I've seen is that because of the time period, what, you know, if there was a work published that could in any way deride the sort of the Christian narrative, you know, it was punishable by death. There was a lot of persecution around that time for anything that wasn't quote unquote gospel, or at least inspired by the gospel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that at that time, it was convert or die, like, simple as that.
Right, exactly. But no, I understand that. And I'm pretty much of the same. I've grappled with it because I've always had somewhat of an adversarial view on the Abrahamic faith. But I understand your point of view. So how did you get into it? I mean, where did this all start for you?
Oh, that's a loaded question, my man. When I was about, I want to say maybe 18, 19 years old, around that time, you know, I'm into metal and stuff like that. So it was exposed to me through music. And I want to say the first example of anything Nordic coming to my attention was the record Tear from Black Sabbath, which came out in the 80s. And I remember reading the back of it, and it was like, you know, there's song titles like Valhalla and, you know, Odin's Court and so on and so forth. And I remember, like, reading this, I'm like, wow, what is this? But it didn't really become a thing until I was listening to, you know, like, early Amon Amarth records a lot, and a lot of the music is Nordic based. So that's what really kind of piqued my interest. And I remember, you know, going to, say, like, Books a Million or something like that back in the day, that goes to show you how old I am. I found, I think it was, what was it? Just like a basic introduction to the runes. It was like this really cheap little book, and it came with like this little plastic bag of just really shitty, like, made in China runes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's when I really started to, like, kind of read into it and, like, oh, what is this? I've never experienced, like, anything like this, because I always grew up, it wasn't, and I want to, like, say, it wasn't in my face, but, you know, my mom was Catholic, my dad was Christian, but we were never really adamant about it. It's like, that was just their faith. And So it wasn't like, you know, a lot of stories I hear where it's like the whole family is this. And if you're anything outside, because, you know, we've all heard the horror stories of the black sheeps in the families, you know.
Oh, yeah, but of course.
I was very fortunate to grow up in a pretty, you know, liberal household where it was just like, you know, find your niche and whatever makes you happy. And then, funny enough, I started to, this is still around like 18, 19 years old, I started to feel this pull to the dark. And I don't know what started or what happened. It just kind of manifested itself. And, you know, at the time I was with a small little, we called them kindreds. It was like, you know, six or seven of us who were into pagan music and, you know, pagan stuff. And I remember telling them like, hey, I'm leaving, you know, leaving the kindred because I'm going to go study the occult. And, you know, they were taken back by that. And they're like, you're going to go do that? I'm like, well, yeah, I feel a draw to it for whatever reason, and I'm going to follow it. And, you know, like every kid around that time, I started, you know, reading about Satanism and so on and so forth. But again, because music is always going to be my number one. I know it sounds strange to say over my spirituality, but to me, music is my religion. So
I completely identify with that.
It goes hand in hand at the same time, but to me, music will always be number one. And, you know, I remember hearing Watain for the first time. And I remember the Sworn to the Dark record, and I put that on, and it fucking blew me away. One, it's a masterpiece, one of the greatest black metal albums I've ever heard. But anyway, the message behind it was deeply rooted, you know, in like anti-cosmic Satanism, Luciferianism, what people know as like, you know, the Temple of the Black Light and so on.
Right. I'm going to get crucified for this. Watain has never done it for me. I think because I found Dissection first and I saw the connection between the two. I've listened to Watain numerous times. I would say that they are probably one of my favorite live bands, but when I listen to their recordings, I don't want to say it feels lifeless, but I just don't really get that connection that I do with Dissection. But I know a lot of people are into Watain, so I'm in the minority on that. But I totally, like, I identify with what you're saying because I had a very similar coming about it. I mean, my way of getting into it was back in, like, 2002, 2003. I got my first laptop, and there was a game that my parents got for me. It was called Age of Mythology, and it was an offshoot of Age of Empires, and it was an RTS game. You know, you play as like a fictional Greek hero, and it's an RTS. So you start out as the Greeks, and you're fighting the Trojans, and then you go to Egypt, and you fight an Egyptian faction, but you use the gods and powers and creatures of Greek mythology, Egyptology, and Norse mythology. And so I was around, God, like six or seven? No, I would have been, about six or seven. And so when I played as the Norse, I was like, whoa, what is this? And then around the same time, my grandmother had like was explaining to me where her family comes from. And so her mother's family is all from Italy. So like northern Italy, near, you know, actual like mainland Europe. But her father's family comes from the Isle of Man. And so when the Norwegian Vikings were, you know, marauding and exploring, that was one of their holdouts, and they ended up settling there. And so her my Manx name, my familial Manx name is Corlett, and if you go back to the Old Norse, it's Thorlett, which means Thor's people. So that was a big deal for me. And so the thing that it was kind of the opposite for me, because I already knew about Vikings, I knew about Norse mythology, and I was really into it. Then I got into metal probably around the age of like 10, and I'm like listening to power metal and old like Black Sabbath and Metallica and stuff like that. And you know, this is about 2005, so YouTube had just come about. And so I would look up Viking music, heavy Viking metal and stuff like that. And so that's how, you know, first I got into folk metal.
Oh, yeah. I used to listen to a lot of that back in the day. And that's one thing that people younger than us are not going to understand. It's like we remember music before YouTube or Spotify.
Right.
Or
I mean, I'm still a cassette head, but that was how my like that's how my parents played music for me was through cassettes. I mean, CDs were there, but they were not as they didn't catch on as early as that. And I think a lot of people think like as soon as the 90s ended, it was all CDs, and that's not how it was at all. I mean, cassettes. Wow. While they did die out in the early 2000s, they were still very much there. And I have a very fond memory. I can remember very specific children's cassettes about dinosaurs that my father would play for me.
That's awesome. I remember my dad, I tell this story to everybody, that my dad had this big green tote box and it had the two open flaps. And inside of it was all the cassette tapes he collected as a kid growing up. So it was Black Sabbath, Motley Crue, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, like, you know, the list goes on and on. And that's how I got into music, was listening to my dad's metal tapes. So thank you, Dad.
Yeah, my father was never into metal. I mean, he had Black Sabbath and Metallica stuff on his iPod, but I gravitated towards that. And like you said, you had this pull to the dark when you were 18 or 19. I felt that when I was like 7, because my grandmother was showing me like kind of like not horror movies, but darker kids movies. And one of her favorite authors and illustrators is a guy named Edward Gorey. And I mentioned him on the podcast last time. But he would basically, one of his famous poems is an alphabet poem, like A, B, C, D. But for every letter, it's a child dying. So A is for Abigail, who fell down the stairs. B is for Basil, who was eaten by bears. And so I got like, I don't know, I was always into morbid stuff. I have a memory of like being in, I guess, third grade, and there was a marathon for the older kids. And so the younger kids were tasked with writing or like creating posters. And so I drew basically a demon, like, you know, like red guy with horns on the track beating everyone else. And this kid next to me, I guess he drew someone getting shot or something, like a runner getting shot to like shooting people to win. And he gets in trouble and he gets really mad because he's like, well, he drew demons on his poster and I'm getting in trouble for having guns. So like, yeah, but that just tells you how early back, like the darkness kind of just filled me.
It's funny because now that I think about it, I remember as a kid, like being into like scary stories to tell in the dark or like Goosebumps.
Oh, yeah, man. So, like, those books are awesome.
I've always had an interest in the quote unquote darker side of life now that I'm thinking about it.
Well, I think it's, you know, for a lot of people, it's with us forever. Like you may not realize it, but like it's with you when you're born. It's like it marks you.
It's funny you say that because I have been kind of coming to that realization myself pretty recently.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like my grandmother still to this day, whenever I tell her about a new band that I'm into or like a new project that I'm doing that's, you know, dark as it always is, she's like, are you ever going to grow out of this? Well, no, sorry. This is just me. I don't know what to tell you.
Yep. I know how that goes.
So trying to think. So you're into this around, you know, 18, 19.
Oh, yes, yes.
What was your first, like, experience with, like, how did you come from paganism to occultism to occult paganism?
And this is where we continue with this little story. So, again, at the time when I was listening to Watain and I was learning about, you know, like the 218 current and so on, it led me to find this very small collection of black metal bands. Again, for me, everything is funneled through music. I found a small little collection of black metal bands in Sweden that were singing about something called dark Germanic heathenism. And this struck me as, and by this time, it was around 2009. I want to say around 2009 is when this happened. So I find this little collection of bands and I started to notice that, like, okay, these aren't like your normal pagan black metal bands. Like, these guys are singing about something pretty dark. And it piqued my interest. So I started reading about it, or trying to, you know, it was very hard to find any kind of information on this, but I ended up finding like the small, like Xerox booklet that was going around. You know, if you could dig through forums or whatever, someone may have had a copy, because, you know, Facebook really wasn't a thing at the time. Instagram didn't exist, you know. So it was still very underground, trying to find any kind of information. So once I did, and I realized that like people are starting to incorporate more like occult within the with paganism, and realizing that, hey, like, you know, yes, there is the Aesir. Yes, there is Odin, Thor, and Frey, and so on. But like, hey, there's a whole other aspect of paganism that no one is talking about, which is giants. And once I realized that, I think that's pretty much when everything just kickstarted into overdrive. And once, you know, I, again, through music, everything is funneled. I started, you know, writing my own music, and I started really diving deep into this ideology. And, you know, I released bands and little EPs that are devoted around this dark Germanic heathenism. And eventually it led me to what is known as Thursa True, which is practiced and spoken through, like, through Arcanum, and there's books written from it from Johan Lager. And again, because everything through me is going to be funneled through music, I'm going to say that 1,000 times, so everyone might as well just get used to it. But
as much as this podcast is about paranormal and occult themes, my musical interests are going to pervade this entire show multiple times. So like part of the, it should be noted that part of our association does come from music, and the fact that we're into the same music, and that you're in a band, Uwata, which, let me just tell you, let me get this out of the way. Fantastic new album. Jin is, I really like it. I like the style that you guys are going in. I like, just everything about it. I mean, it's a little bit different, I guess, since the last album, but I really appreciate it. I feel it's a little bit more melodic, and I enjoy melodic stuff as much as I like the sort of atonal dissonant stuff.
I appreciate that. And that was a really fun record to write, especially being with dudes that I like being around, and I love them like brothers. So thank you. That was a fun record to be on. And album 4 is going to kick all your asses. Trust me.
I'm excited. You brought up Arcanum, and I love Arcanum, and that also is where I even discovered Thursa True and sort of the darker aspects of paganism. But I remember being in, God, it probably was like 8th grade, and I found the music video for Gavafrun Chalen, and I showed it to people, and if I wasn't an outcast already, boy, that just killed me.
That video is absolutely legendary. It's one of the best black metal videos ever. As goofy as it is, it's the fucking shit.
But what's funny is that, you know, I knew about Arcanum back in middle school, and I was a fan, but I didn't understand. I had no idea that, like, he was talking about Thursa True. I thought he was just talking about paganism and like Norse paganism, maybe from a darker lens, but I didn't know that there was a whole spiritual tradition tied to it. Once you understand that, or at least for me, once I understood that, I went back and I listened to it and I watched that video again. I'm like, oh wow, this video actually really encapsulates what he's talking about. Like, this video is a really good example of the material he's writing.
I mean, he's walking around the forest as a troll. I mean, how more Nordic can you get, you know?
Right, exactly.
And I think it's really interesting that when it comes to, you know, again, there's different, you know, traditions or paths or whatever you want to call them. Like, there's the true, there's this early, you know, early conception that I mentioned earlier called dark Germanic heathenism. And now with what I'm doing with Nyrfyrstablot, I think that you're starting to see more of a spotlight being put on other than what is just shoved in our faces all the time when it comes to paganism, especially the Nordic tradition.
Well, yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I was so fortunate to come across you and your book, is because, you know, as I've said, I've been calling myself a pagan since I was like 7 years old. I never had a practice with it. My version of that was just when I would go out into the woods, if I saw two ravens, I would acknowledge it and think like, oh, okay, Odin's there. Or if, you know, if I found a stray cat, like, you know, that to me was a sign that Freya might be around. Mm-hmm. But once I started getting into the actual practice of it, which was probably like beginning of 2020, the thing that just kept getting shoved in my face was acid trew.
Mm-hmm.
And on the surface, it's
understandably so.
Right. And on the surface, it's great because it's really the only one you'll hear about unless you dig deeper. My issue with it was, so you're a group of pagans, yet you have this super dogmatic view that only the main gods, the more humanistic gods, can be worshipped. And anything other than that is sort of blasphemy and heresism in your belief. And I couldn't really understand that, because as cool as Odin and Freya is, like, the Jotuns are cool. Like, they're badass. And so are, like, you know, the Dark Elves and the Gnomes and the Landvetir. All of it, just, I didn't quite understand why they were choosing this, like, one specific aspect of this massive pantheon that they could have been drawing from. It just seems so limiting.
I think it's because maybe it's because when Asta Tru, I don't have any kind of notes or anything in front of me, and it probably wasn't a good idea, but Asta Tru, I mean, it's a relatively new belief, you know, quote unquote, because, you know, or it's like, maybe it's our idea of what a reconstructed pagan belief would be. But yeah, I think it's very strange to see people kind of put like a dogmatic view on a, what I consider to be a wild and tribal, you know, religious practice, or maybe even just spiritual belief. I don't think we know enough to maybe actually say that this was a religion to them.
Maybe, yeah. And the thing that I've always said, like, since I was, you know, a kid, was like, this feels really primal. It just feels it feels dirty, but not in a bad way.
Well, it's very salt of the earth, because everything revolving around, you know, Germanic and so on tribes in Europe was Mother Earth. You know, that right. is what I did. You know, the invisible man in the sky didn't provide, but the earth provided. You know, the sky provided, the animals provided. So it makes sense to look at it as more of a, you know, salt of the earth spiritual belief rather than a religious practice, which is, I find it very hard to believe that the, you know, the Vikings were religious. I mean, yes, there was the sacred temple of Uppsala, and they did, you know, have a 9-year gathering. But again, is that religious practice, or is that just,
I think it's just tradition. I think that they were doing stuff that their family had done for hundreds of years before them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, tradition sounds a little more believable to me, as opposed to, like, this is religion. Like, I don't know. That just sounds, it sounds too hardcore to me.
Well, this is the thing that I shouldn't say drive me nuts. I've always felt that modern heathenry, like, spend so much time trying to get away from the monotheistic Abrahamic framework that they end up adopting a lot of their practices, in the sense that, you know, the dualism, the dogmas, and I guess that probably comes from a lot of people who get into acid trew and just heathenry in general. They're most likely coming from, it's sort of a rebellion, at least it starts that way, from like a very Christian upbringing. So I understand it from that end. It's very ironic, and that's why I don't understand why, I guess for me, when I look at it, I try and I think that's why I even brought up the idea of the Eddas being somewhat Christianized, is mm-hmm. that I don't want monotheism anywhere near it. I don't want to see, I want this to be completely away from monotheism. I want it to be its own thing. That's how I view it. And so I always get confused when I see all these new groups coming up, and yet they're all kind of using this monotheistic, not worldview, because they're polytheists in their belief, but the actual actions that they take feel very monotheist.
And, you know, it's funny you say that, because I think that just further proves my point of why Snorri's prose Edda is a credible source of information. And that's because, yes, even though he was a Christian at the time, he was still writing down a tradition of people that came before him. And even though there's very slight Christian influences, like saying that this is a demon, or, you know, it's just very small, subtle things of like saying hell is hell instead of...
Well, know, I've been told that hell, he put that apparently hell doesn't actually exist, that was never even a part of the Norse tradition, and that he put that in to have a mirror to Christianity in the Norse belief. And so a lot of people feel that his interpretation of hell, if it really is a part of the Norse pantheon, which I believe it is, that it's, well, it's very Christian in the sense that the underworld is dark and bad and negative, and I don't feel that way at all within the Norse tradition.
Well, that's the thing, is like, once you go into the Prose Edda and understand that, yes, there's going to be very small, minute Christian, like, I'm glad you said that word, interpretations of these stories. Snorri is not going in and saying hell is the Christian hell and it's purgatory and you're going to burn. No, it's not saying that. This is just a Christian interpreting oral traditions and stories that came before him. I don't think he's necessarily doing it to make things Christian. I think it's just him interpreting pagan beliefs and stories from a Christian point of view. I think that's what it is. And even so, I personally believe it's to such a small degree that it doesn't ruin that book. I think it's an excellent source of information as well as the poetic Edda.
No, I agree. And I love the Eddas and they're great stories. I mean, he was a fantastic writer. Just his ability to write and keep you entertained and drawn into the stories, it's fantastic. And I think he was really ahead of his time in the way that he wrote it. And that's why the Eddas are so, not even for just pagans, but like literary enthusiasts and academics. Mm-hmm. It's such a pillar of work that it's brought on into the modern day and used in so many inspirations, as well as Saxo Grammaticus, his History of the Danes. I don't know if you saw that the guy who made The Lighthouse and The Witch is making a new Viking movie.
I have, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it.
Yeah, so apparently that is a retelling of a story from the History of the Danes. It's at least from the trailer. I watched a trailer analysis a while ago, but it's altered in a little bit. It's taking out pieces and adding pieces that weren't in the original story, but more overall, it's a retelling of that story from the History of the Danes. And I have that book. I haven't read it yet. I need to dig into it because it does seem interesting. Apparently only the first 9 chapters or only 9 books pertain to heathens or pagans, and the rest kind of gets very Christianized. Mm-hmm. But I think it's still a very interesting work that I need to dig into.
I mean, if I had it, I definitely would read it. Sounds interesting enough.
Yeah, I mean, I'm also a huge history person. I love history.
I think that's what's kind of what brought my attention to the Norse in general, was just history in general. I've always been a huge fan of history. It was the only, class in school that I gave a shit about. Everything else.
Exactly. I'm the same way.
I want to learn about what happened in the world before me.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that there's just so much that you can learn from history, in the sense that you can use it to see what's going on now and how it repeats itself. And you can kind of use it as a guide for how to go forward from it. It's just everything about it is so useful.
Oh, yeah. Humans are very predictable.
Yeah, absolutely. So getting into your book, the one thing that I wanted to ask you about. So you bring up there's a distinction between the Thursian bloodline, the Thursian lineage, and the Jotun as a whole. Can you go into a little bit of that and explain your theories and how you came to that? I mean, it's a pretty, not obvious, but like I kind of had that same feeling when I was first really digging into the lore, but I'm interested to see like where you came with that.
So I think if you read the Eddas, you'll see that everything living or since has passed living, or since has passed living, sorry, everything comes from Ymir. Everything. He is the first being. He created everything. The sky, the ground, the water, the earth, everything, literally. He begot children. Their children had children, so on and so forth. Even though Budude was licked from the rime salt, still he consorted with a giant, and eventually Odin came along. So when I see people, like you were mentioning earlier, how like a lot of people, especially in like Asatru, were saying like the gods are good and the giants are bad, and everything, you know, outside of that pantheon is, you know, quote unquote evil or whatever. It's just a strange concept to me, but hey, to each their own. You'll see that the Jotuns in particular, pertaining to your question, well, they come from this singular being, which is Ymir. So do the gods, because of Odin. Now, even though I don't believe Odin's brothers had children, as far as my knowledge goes.
Did you ever notice how weird it is that they aren't really talked about in the Eddas or the lore? Like, Vili and Ve, like, they're there sometimes, but they are not brought up many times in the bulk of the work?
And it's funny you say that, because there are a lot of, I'll say, quote-unquote, characters or names, we'll just say names, in the Poetic Edda and the Prose Edda, but you're only heard about, like, this group, you know what I mean? But if you go through, it'll name, you know, there. I think there's one section there where it's, like, a page and a half of names of dwarves, you know what
I mean? Oh, yeah,
and
I mean, that's where Tolkien got...
Yeah. There was a page and a half of names of giants and giantesses, but, you know, there's just so much in this world. And I think that shows you how expansive it really is like, even though the microscope is on the giants and the Aesir and men. And if you look, there's, you know, there's the dwarves, there's the elves, there's the trolls, there's the wolves, there's this and that. There's this huge, you know, universe within Norse mythology that goes very unexamined.
No, I agree. I mean, I didn't even know about the god Ullr until I really started digging into the Eddas, because if you just get like a history of Norse paganism or like a Norse mythology book, entities like Ullr do not get brought up at all.
And that's the thing is the...
Or like Hermother, he doesn't even really register with most people. They don't, like, they know the name, but they can't think of his significance within the lore.
Or people only know who Heimdall is because of the Marvel movies, you know what I mean?
Right. Oh, boy. We're going to get into that, but, oh, God, but, I can't stand those movies.
But I think it's very interesting when people point out that, you know, the Jotuns are bad. I'm like, well, they're bad in what sense?
Well, this is the rampant Christian interpretation of the Norse tradition.
I guess I have to keep reminding myself that that's a thing, because I don't look at it from that viewpoint.
Yeah, so well, neither do I, but I'm super conscious of it because I see it everywhere. I mean, the amount of, like I said, I got someone told me that hell doesn't exist in the Norse tradition. That's a Christian add-on to mirror it to Christianity.
Well,
and that's not somewhere true. You go when you die.
Well, it's not true at all, because hell does exist.
Right, I agree.
Hellheimer is a place, but it is not the Christian purgatory that is what is, you know, what you find in a lot of Abrahamic religions. It's just simply the underworld, the land of the dead. That's where you go. If you do not die a glorified death in battle and do not go to Valhalla, then you go to hell. It's like the Greek underworld, you know what I mean? Like there's nothing bad about it. That's just where you go after you die.
Exactly. And from a lot of the things that I've read, that hell herself is a very caring entity. She's stern. She does not move on her positions whatsoever, i.e. Baldur. But if you do end up in hell, there's nothing to worry about. There's nothing to be afraid of. It's just kind of like living a little bit more of an elevated life like you did on Earth, but it's just a little bit more elevated. It's a little bit more, almost cushier from a lot of the interpretations I've seen.
Well, I can say that from my, you know, personal spiritual work with Hell, she's not very caring or cozy.
Okay. See, that's the thing is, like, when I went from just calling myself quote unquote a pagan to actually wanting to venerate the gods and get into a practice, Hell and Jormungandr were the two that really stuck out to me and felt like I felt a pull, especially from Jormungandr, and that's something I'll get into a little bit later. But Hell, I've always had an interest in, not just because, you know, she is the ruler of the underworld and I've always been into dark stuff. I just always found her story and her interpretation and her sort of the way that she does things very appealing to me.
It's funny you say that because I kind of went through like a three-step program. I know it's funny to say, but when I started getting into the more darker aspect of Norse magic, my first, like the first entity there, or deity, or whatever you want to call it, I'll just say entity, I think that's better, that stuck out to me was Fenrisulfin. And, well, I mean, I've had a fascination with wolves ever since I was a kid.
So was I, and I think you and I being into black metal, definitely, there's something there.
Oh, absolutely. Wolves is like, you know, black metal wolves, and Watsane has the wolf logo. You know what I mean? Wolves are very prominent in black metal.
But, absolutely.
Like, even as a kid, you know, my dad, he always had little wolf statues, or, you know, my favorite movie in the world growing up because of my dad is Dances with Wolves. Like, Native American culture was always very, very present in my family growing up from my dad. So, like, that love of wolves kind of came from him. And then growing up, you know, getting into black metal and so forth, it just became a part of my identity.
My grandmother has a huge fascination with wolves, and so that got brought on to me when I was younger. And I've always had a big fascination with wolves. I mean, she has wolf paintings and wolf pictures all over her house. And so, like, you know, like you said, like, Fenris is definitely one of the entities that stuck out to me even as a little kid. I used to, not anymore, but I used to have family that was married into the family that they were from Sweden. And my aunt had a German shepherd named Freya. And so, like, you know, I would call her, you know, the Northern Wolf. And my grandparents have always had German shepherds. And so I've always equated that with wolves. And, you know, so that just that connection has always been there for me as well.
Oh, yeah, man. And it's not something that you're going to have a scarcity of when it comes to metal. That's for sure.
Oh, not at all.
Very clear. But so with him being like my first step into, you know, darker Nordic magic, eventually that led me to Hell, which was like my second step, you could say. And I was working with Hell for quite a while. And she is very unforgiving in her wisdom. That's definitely one thing I always want to make a point to when people ask me about like my practice or, you know, how do I, you know, incorporate this god into my ritual, you know, it's like questions like that. And I always say that if you're going to work with darker energy, you better be prepared to sacrifice what is needed in order to obtain that wisdom from that energy, because it's not free.
No, not at all. And that, I think that's why when I began to practice, I was kind of, you know, I was reading the Eddas and I was reading other kind of like, you know, how to pagan books. And yeah. There's actually a really good book, and I don't know if you know it. It's called The Way of Fire and Ice, and it's by Ryan Smith. And it's great because it's a very non-dogmatic look at how to practice Norse paganism. And there's, you know, in certain areas of the book, he gives you exercises and they're like meditations. Oh, cool. And so one of them is like the beginnings of deity work. And it's essentially, you know, find a deity that you connect with and look up their names and titles and the titles that they're associated with throughout history, and pick four of them or three of them plus their actual name, and sit down, close your eyes, and just whisper the titles and names three times over and over and over again. And so in the book, he even says, you know, start out with the Aesir or the Vanir, and then if you want to, move on to the Jotun. And I always thought that was cool because most pagan books, it just doesn't, it either doesn't get talked about it or you're told to avoid it.
Hmm. That's interesting. I think it's cool. I've never heard of that author or that book, but I'm definitely interested in it. I would like to check it out because I think that's something that I provided as well in my book is a very non-dogmatic or...
No, you did. Absolutely. And that's one thing that I'm really... Like, again, when I found it, it just felt like this was made for me because, you know, like I said, I got into the actual practice. I looked at Acid True and I was kind of turned away by how dogmatic it was and the fact that, you know, I'll give you a little story. I was using, you know, because of the pandemic and such, I was using meetup groups to try and find other pagans. And so it was all video chat. And so I was in this group, I think it was like Church of the Earth. It was like a pagan conglomerate from North Carolina. And so all these people were talking about different deities that they work with, but it was all, you know, light and good vibes and love. And I came in with, well, you know, guys, you know, I would really like to go and find up some animal bones and, you know, just bury them in the ground for a while and then put them on my altar. And because I feel like these are pretty chaotic primal gods, and I got kicked out of that group. So I was struggling to find where I fit in with this, because that's been a pattern of mine throughout my life, is no matter what I've been into, I've always never quite fit in, even with the weird stuff. I mean, with black metal, I love raw analog black metal. Like, I'm kind of one of those gatekeepers that if it's too good production, I'm kind of, you know, I'm kind of against it. So when I found, you know, when I found Thursa True, I was looking at him like, okay, this is really cool. And then I think somewhere in the website, because his books are impossible to find, they're all sold out. No one has a copy. I think there's a couple copies on eBay for $500. Not going to do that. So on the website, it talks about, you know, this is venerating the Jotun and the offspring of Loki. We do not talk about the Aesir. We do not venerate the Vanir. It's off limits. And I'm thinking, well, why don't I just go to church? What is the difference here? So when I found yours and I was looking through it and we were talking about what it was and how open it was to everything and using everything in the Norse pantheon, it just felt like I was coming home, basically.
That's really awesome to hear, man. Thank you very much. And I think it's important that when you're looking at things from a magical standpoint, you know, even though I am and always will be very heavily rooted in the left-hand path, I believe that if you see, how do I explain this? I don't want to, like, you know, contradict myself, but I think that even though, again, I walk the left-hand path, I have a very middle-of-the-road viewpoint of how to practice said path, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. No, I know exactly what you mean. And it shows, and it's just so nice to read something that is non-limiting.
I think it's important to not be limiting, because if you put, let's say, you know, you have a box in front of you and everything that I believe needs to be in this box, I was like, okay, well then you're closing yourself off to possibility. And that's, if you're already limiting your potential, you're not going to be able to realize your potential.
No, exactly. And I've pretty much said the same thing to you, is like, why you have this beautifully intricate and very powerful tradition and pantheon full of many different entities, not just gods, not just giants, that can be worked with, venerated, communicated with, and you're shutting 90% out just for the ones that look or seem like you. And I've never been able to get behind that interpretation of it. So this book and this system and this tradition that you have, it's one that makes the most sense to me. Out of everything I've read about Norse, like modern pagan traditions, this one feels like the smartest one. One of the things that I got very annoyed with was that because I've been into the occult and paganism for the same amount of time. I got into the occult when I was about 6. I got into paganism when I was about 7. Never practice it, just always been an armchair occultist. You know, I liked the imagery, I liked the aesthetic, I liked reading about it, but I never knew how to practice it. And one thing, and I don't know if you've ever encountered this, when I was probably 16 or 17, I was looking at Aleister Crowley and I was like, you know what? I want to do this. Like, this is something that I feel I don't identify with my Jewish roots. I certainly don't identify with any Christianization. But this occult stuff really rings a bell for me. And so I would go to shows and see people with occult necklaces on or tattoos and things like that. And I would go up to them and say, like, hey, are you into the occult? Do you practice? Are you into mysticism? And they're like, yeah. And so I'd be like, okay, well, I want to do that. I have no idea where to start. Can you help me? Can you show me, you know, what to do or give me some references for me to read? And a lot of people said, well, if you're asking that question, you shouldn't be into it in the first place. And so I got shut down everywhere I went for years. And so I kind of gave up on the idea of practicing it because I felt like, well, if everyone's just going to be a dick about it, why am I even trying? And so then, but after a while, you know, being home from the pandemic, I started reading more and was like, I found some actual like how-to guides. And I guess maybe that wasn't such a thing back in, you know, like late 2000s, 2008, 2009. But I'm glad I found it. And this book is just, it's like that. But the point I'm trying to make is that when I was getting into occultism, I didn't really identify with the ceremonial magic because it was very like venerating God and talking, you know, commanding demons from the Abrahamic point of view and using God as your anchor. I don't buy that. So I don't really feel a pull to that, but I do feel this pull to paganism. How can I incorporate like ritual magic with paganism? And a lot of the pagans I would talk to would say, well, that doesn't exist. You can't do that. We only use bloats and marriage ceremonies. We're not occultists. And so I got very discouraged. And then I found your book. And it, like I said, I'll keep saying it. It felt like I was coming home. It felt like I finally found this thing that I've been looking for so long.
That's fucking awesome. So three things. One, to make you feel better. The person you asked and they told you, well, if you don't know, you shouldn't be in it. I can guarantee you that person probably has no fucking clue what they're talking about. And the reason why I say that is because if you're a true occultist, and you're not willing to share wisdom and knowledge with someone who is willing to sit and listen, you completely miss the entire point of being into magic or a cult or anything like that. That's just my personal belief.
Well, I think there were a few people that said that to me, more or less the same thing. And I would imagine that they were probably a Satanist of some kind, probably a Levian Satanist. And so they probably took the more self-centered aspects of Levian philosophy to heart and was like, oh, well, you know, if you're asking me, then you don't belong in this. You should be doing it all yourself. You shouldn't ask for help. You shouldn't, you know, you should be completely self-independent.
Yeah, I'm not buying that. I can't get into that. Like,
No, me neither. I've never been into LaVey, but I'm just saying that's, I would suspect that that's probably where they were coming from when they answered me like that. It's still not very helpful.
No, I think that's very weird because I don't believe on putting a price on wisdom. And I know that's very strange for me to say as an author who sells books, but at the same time, it's like, I'm very thankful and very fortunate that Fall of Man has been working with me and, you know, getting my work out to people. And
it's a great publisher. I have enjoyed, a couple of their publications and they're great.
I want, you know, Alex, you're the man. Thank you so much for everything you've done for me. There is not a soul on this earth I would trust if there's a blot with, but Alex. That's it. He's the only one. He believed in me. He gave me a shot, and he truly believed in the work I was doing. And I'm very, 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 very thankful. I'm getting tongue-tied. I'm very, very thankful for that. So again, thank you, Apollo Man, for working with me. And I forgot where I was going with that. I'm sorry.
Well, you said three things.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. I just think that the way that you wrote it and the way that this book is very approachable. It's very different from a lot of the more secluded occult paths. And so I'm going to use it. And I think I told you today, I went out and did a meditation on the Thurisos rune, and it was very interesting. I mean, normally I get kind of like that vibration from meditation. But with that, it was just a lot stronger, and the visualizations were a lot stronger. I have very bad ADD, and meditation has always been somewhat frustrating to me because I don't know if I'm doing it right, because I just sit out there, eyes closed. I have to put a sleep mask on because I cannot keep my eyes closed. And so I'm thinking like, okay, how do I empty my mind? And so eventually I was just like, I'm just going to sit here and relax and just see what happens. And eventually, after a while, my mind would calm down and I could just kind of zone out, and it got me to relax. I still don't know if I'm meditating correctly, but I never had very strong mental visuals when I would do it. And so doing it today on the Thurisos rune, just crazy visuals. I can't even tell you what they were about. It was just so much, but they were all very centered. And I've never really experienced that before yet.
It's, one thing I always like to say to people is that the most potent magic you could ever truly perform is through meditation. As much as we all want to romanticize, you know, rituals and ceremonies and stuff like that, if you really truly want to sit down and dig deep and really fucking learn something, shut your mind off and just meditate. That's the, honestly, man, it's the best source of information you can ever get outside of yourself. It's because you're putting yourself in a very placid stasis, and you have nothing to distract you other than what's behind your eyes. And what that is, depending on, you know, what the intent is of your meditation, can open up a world of possibility within magic. And I think that's something that really goes unexamined. And I don't understand why you don't hear a lot about people talking about meditation when it comes to occult magic and such. I don't know. I always try to put an emphasis on that in my work. And I put a meditation ritual in my book that I do myself. And it's one of the very few things I share about my practice. And it's only because I believe that meditation is truly the best well you can draw from when it comes to receiving any kind of wisdom or knowledge or energy. That's the big one, is energy. Is meditate, people. You have no idea how beneficial it is to your spirit.
And that was my interview with Nidjifol, author and musician. What an amazing talk. And this will be the first part of two parts of the interview. And we are going to be having him on again in the near future to talk about other practices and other esoteric topics, as well as some more of his experiences, and maybe even a couple roundtables with some of our other guests. All of his information will be in the show notes as far as where you can buy his books and new book, where you can hear his music, and all of his other information. The Patreon is up, and like I said at the beginning of this episode, there will be merchandise for each of the tiers and information on each of the tiers and how the Patreon is going to work. We have a number of new options for the Patreon, and many ways for you to get involved with the show, including being a guest on the show and participating in AMA series. We will also be doing on-site investigations, Alden and I, in the near future, and we really are excited about that. That's going to propel a lot of what we're talking about in these episodes into a new realm. So we are very excited for all of that, and we're very excited for you to be on this journey with us. So with that, I'm Octavian Graves, and you have a fantastic night, and see you next time.